Prophecies of the Messiah. The eighth talk in a series on 1 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on December 24, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week at the end of my talk, I made some comments. I made basically three points in my comments, and I found out during the week that all of them required much more elaboration than I had time to do. But I don't want to take the time to do that today. I wanted to do something more Christmassy. And unfortunately, as far as following up on what I talked about last week, this is my last time teaching for a while. So I won't be able to do that in the next few weeks. But those are the kinds of issues that I'm sure will come up again in various forums, and there will be other opportunities to talk about it. What I do talk about today will kind of take a glancing blow at a couple of things I said last week, so maybe in questions and comments we can pursue that a little bit further. What I want to talk about today comes from there are a couple of things that have been going on in my mind that gave rise to what I want to talk about. Some of it are the things that we talked about in 1 Samuel and the selection of a king and how you know a king when you see one. And the other is just some things that I've been thinking about with respect to Christ and his first coming, and kind of mulling that over in my mind about how he showed up and how one recognizes him. And so I thought that I could bring those two together and it would be appropriate for Christmas. So that's kind of what's in the back of my mind. This topic of what does God look like when he takes human form is an interesting one. And its antithesis, what does Satan look like when he takes human form? Those are themes that show up in literature numerous times. In Goethe's Faust, we have Satan appearing as a human being, as a character. In The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, we have Satan appearing in human form. And he tells the story of Jesus, with Pontius Pilate, which is also an interesting characterization of Jesus. Then in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, we have an incident called the Grand Inquisitor, in which Jesus comes and talks to the head of the Inquisition. So this is a theme that has, and there are others, there are lots of others, but this is a theme that has been common in literature. What does Satan look like when he takes human form, and what does God look like when he takes human form? I have often thought I would like to write a novel. I think at best I've only got one in me, but it is something that I would like to try sometime. And this kind of theme is the kind of theme that I would most like to explore. But the question that I've been turning over in my mind is, if God took human form, how would you spot him? How would you know that was him? What would be the distinguishing characteristics? What would be the marks that would make it possible to tell that's what you're dealing with? And today I'd like to look at it a little bit more narrowly. What if we had lived in the year 20 AD? And living in Nazareth, and Jesus comes walking down the street, would you have spotted him? Would you have been able to tell This is the Messiah. This is the one that was prophesied. As I've thought about that, I oftentimes I kind of casually think, well, sure, I would have spotted him because I would have known the Old Testament prophecies. I would have known what was coming. And in my more sober moments, I realized that that's optimistic. But I wanted to look at, take kind of a whirlwind tour of the prophecies in the Old Testament, just and thinking in terms of what did God tell people in advance with respect to this coming Messiah? What was the nature of the information that God had given out in advance? And how helpful would that have been in identifying the coming Messiah? So I'm going to do a whirlwind tour of the Old Testament prophecies of the Messiah. I found a website to help me out. There are lots of websites devoted to this topic. There was one that had 433 Old Testament prophecies with respect to the Messiah, and I figured that's my site. And I did go through and very quickly look at all of them. I have not studied all of them. I just read through them. Some of them I have studied, others I haven't really studied. And what I'm going to do is not go through all 433. You're welcome. But I'm just going to hit some of the highlights, some of the ones that I think are most significant and the most characteristic of what you find in general. And I'm going to go through these in the order in which they occur in the Old Testament, and in this case it turns out to be in the chronological order more or less as well. And hopefully you get somewhat of a picture of how the prophecies kind of developed and elaborated on this theme and what kind of picture someone in 20 AD could have had in mind in thinking about this coming Messiah. After I go through this, then I'll briefly summarize that picture, and then I want to talk about the significance of the way that God chose to become one of us. The first hint we get of this coming Messiah is in Genesis, and as I've looked at Genesis, I think that this is indeed a prophecy of the coming Messiah, and indeed was even early on understood to be a prophecy of something, of someone coming. If you'll recall, this is in Genesis 3, right after the fall. Adam and Eve had eaten of the fruit. They had disobeyed God, and God came to them and was informing them of now how will things be different as a result of what they had done. And he says, and in the process of telling them how things will be different, he proclaims a curse on the serpent who had been the agent of the temptation and the evil that came into the world at that time. And he says to the serpent, and this is Genesis 3:15, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel." So there's going to be enmity between the woman and the serpent, and I think here the serpent is understood to be the agent of evil. There's going to be enmity between the woman who is later on is developed as the woman is the carrier of the seed, the one who will bring the seed along. So the woman and the agent of evil, and between your seed, that is the descendants of the serpent, the descendants of the agent of evil, and her seed, that is that which is to come. And then referring to her seed shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him, that is, her seed, on the heel. So the idea is there is some kind of salvation coming. It's not clear what this salvation is. But this salvation in the sense of the agent of evil being done away with, a mortal wound will be inflicted on the agent of evil. But in the process, there will be injury done to that one, the seed, that will mortally wound the agent of evil. So it's not really clear what is being prophesied exactly. This isn't being very specific. But evil is going to be destroyed. And there will be someone who comes along, born of the woman, who will be the one who does that. And I'm confident that Adam and Eve understood that to be a prophecy of some kind of salvation coming through the descendants of the woman. And I think that helps explain why there was so much rejoicing at the birth of the firstborn, Cain. And it wasn't just the first child born, which would have been an amazing event, but this child had the promise, had the potential of being the fulfillment of this prophecy, the one who would do in evil. And I think that's why it was so disappointing when Cain turned out to be the kind of person he turned out to be. The next prophecy is given to Abraham. The next one of, and I'm leaving out some stuff. We could talk about Noah. There are other things that we could talk about, but I'm just hitting really the very high points. To Abraham, God appears, and God singles Abraham out for a special blessing. And he proclaims that in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3. Here's what he says to Abraham. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So what he's telling Abraham is going to be unique. He has been selected out to be the father of a people, a great nation, so a people that is numerous and significant. And God is going to bless that people. They are going to be unique in the earth, have a unique assignment. And through that people, he says, and so you shall be a blessing. So that people is going to be the source of blessing to others. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. So this people is then going to be kind of the barometer for how God relates to people. That those who look kindly upon the descendants of Abraham and bless the descendants of Abraham will be blessed, and those who curse them will be cursed. And then he points out, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham is going to be the vehicle for the development of this nation through which the entire earth will be blessed. Jacob, when he was getting very old, proclaimed blessings on all of his sons, the sons who became the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And in his blessing on Judah, who was singled out for a unique blessing, he says this. This is in Genesis 49, 10 and 11. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. So he's saying to Judah that the scepter will not depart from that tribe. So the scepter, the symbol of rule and authority. So apparently the kingly line will develop in Judah and will not depart from that tribe. It will remain in the tribe of Judah. It says, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until, and then this translation, this is the NASB, says until Shiloh comes. That's a difficult line, and there's it's not clear what is meant by Shiloh here. In the Septuagint, This is translated until he comes to whom it belongs. And that's also the way that this was taken in by the people at Qumran. This is the way they understood this passage in Genesis. So the scepter, this rule, this sign of authority will not depart from Judah until the one comes to whom it belongs. So there's someone who, in particular in that line for whom the scepter is particularly appropriate. The next section is in 1 Samuel. This was in Hannah's song, and we talked about this just a few weeks ago. Hannah gave this song, which concludes with these verses, this verse in 1 Samuel 2:10. And here she was rejoicing in the fact that righteousness will win out. God will make sure that righteousness wins out and is vindicated. And in 2:10 she says, "Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king and will exalt the Lord of his anointed." So it makes it specific here that we're going to have a king who is a representative, a unique representative of God, to whom God will give power and authority. And it is presumably through this king that the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. So a kingdom that extends worldwide. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, God is talking to David. And he makes a promise and a prophecy with respect to him. 2 Samuel 7, 9 through, or I'm sorry, 8 through 17. "Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel and plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again. Nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David." So David here is, according to this prophecy, is being singled out, that the line, the king, and it is not clear whether it's a single person or whether it's a succession of kings, a dynasty, but in any case, that will come from David himself. And there will be an eternal kingdom that is established that will be ruled over by the descendant or the descendants of David. And Israel, another theme that keeps showing up, is Israel will be given, finally be given peace, given rest from all its surrounding enemies. So we've narrowed it down. First it was Abraham would be the father of a great nation. Then Judah would be the tribe in which the scepter would eventually be given. And now it will be a descendant of David that will be the head of that dynasty that will last forever. Now, there are a number of psalms that have language that is very suggestive of Jesus, in particular in the sufferings that Jesus experienced. Let's look at Psalm 22, 1 through 21. As I said, there are several of these, but this one is particularly significant because on the cross, Jesus refers to quotes the first lines from this psalm. And I'll read the first 21 verses. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. O my God, I cry by day, but thou dost not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Yet thou art holy, O thou who art enthroned upon the praises of Israel. In thee our fathers trusted, they trusted, and thou didst deliver them. To thee they cried out, and were delivered. In thee they trusted, and were not disappointed. But I am a worm, and not a man, a reproach of men, and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip, and they wag the head, saying, Commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him. Yet thou art he who didst bring me forth from the womb. Thou didst make me trust when upon my mother's breasts. Upon thee I was cast from birth. Thou hast been my God from my mother's womb. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me, as a ravening and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and thou dost lay me in the dust of death. For dogs have encircled me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. But thou, O Lord, be not far off. O thou, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, and from the horns of the wild oxen thou dost answer me. It goes on. But this psalm is apparently born out of the experience of David, a situation in which, and there are several of these situations, psalms that deal with this kind of theme, where David is scorned by those around him, that David understands that he is a servant of God, that he is faithful to God, and yet there are people around him that mock him and say and question whether he has been faithful to God and is worthy of any divine favor. And David, suffering from this kind of mocking of him and persecution even of him, he calls out to God and expresses the kind of suffering that he's experiencing in very poetic terms. I don't know why David chose the wording that he chooses, but there are some interesting phrases that he employs. In verse 16, they pierced my hands and my feet. I don't know what he had in mind when he's just saying that, but what we see in the life of Christ and his sufferings is that these poetic phrases become literally true. That Jesus' hands were indeed pierced and his feet were indeed pierced. Later on, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. I don't know what David had in mind, but this poetic language becomes literally true in Christ's experience. So there are a number of psalms that describe the same kind of theme, and David uses poetic language to express his suffering, and yet many of those things become literally true in the death of suffering and death of Christ. But not all of them become literally true. Let's look at Psalm 69:21, just very briefly. 69:21, that it's a similar kind of context, and I'll just read the one verse. It says, "They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." The vinegar to drink literally comes true. I don't think the gall for food comes true, but my memory may be failing me. But as you go through these, some of these become literally true, some of them don't in the sufferings of Christ. So they aren't really predictive. It's not the kind of thing that a reader could have been expected to see as foretelling Christ, but they are things that become literally true in the life of Christ. Then we get into the prophetic literature, the writings of the prophets themselves. And here it becomes particularly difficult to interpret sometimes what the author has in mind, but there is much to say about the coming Messiah. The first one is in Isaiah chapter 9. I'll read verses 1 through 7. Interestingly, I found another website where it talked about Jewish understandings of the prophecies regarding the Messiah. And it seems to be unanimous among the Jewish scholars, among the rabbis, that this particular verse, this particular section, and chapter 11 of Isaiah are both with respect to the Messiah. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 9. "But there will be no more gloom for her who is in anguish. In earlier times he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Thou shalt multiply the nation. Thou shalt increase their gladness. They will be glad in thy presence as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou shalt break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak roiled up in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this." So according to this section, Isaiah is predicting that there will be this time when light will shine into the darkness. Things will be made clear. Things that could not be seen will be made visible. And he makes reference to this happening on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. So it's associating it with a geographical area in Israel that is Galilee. And it talks about this child that will be born to us. The government will rest on his shoulders. And it gives him some names: Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. And there's much debate as to whether any of those can be genuinely seen to predict the divinity of the Messiah. Some say that mighty God and eternal Father are predictive of the divinity of the coming Messiah, but others question whether those actually make such a claim. Isaiah 11. I'll quickly read the first 10 verses. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from its roots will bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. The wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, and the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Then it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. There are no real new indicators of the Messiah that we can pick up here. Most of this has been mentioned elsewhere, but it's reiterated here. And we have quite a bit of talk about this coming one, this Messiah, in many of the prophets. In Isaiah, there's another section which is a little hard to know how to understand them. Several chapters refer to this suffering servant, one who will is a servant of God who will suffer intensely for his people. Let's just look at chapter 53 as an example of that. And I will read this quickly. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face, he was despised and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried, yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening of our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we were healed. We are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of all of us to fall on him. He was oppressed and was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due. His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief, and he would render himself as a guilt offering. He will see his offering, he will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him in a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death, and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors." It's hard to know how to interpret these suffering servant chapters, but they all seem to be in reference to Christ and his sufferings on the cross. They aren't extremely explicit as to exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. So it's difficult to use these as a way of identifying the Messiah. But the theme that is here is quite clear, is that someone is going to suffer the punishment that is owed to us. I'm going to skip ahead for the sake of time. Jeremiah, there are a couple passages in Jeremiah, but they don't add any new things to look for to identify this Messiah. There's more in Daniel, but that's in the form of visions, prophetic visions that are extremely difficult to interpret. I'll just read one of those just as a sampling. Daniel 9:24-27. I just have to find Daniel. This is like a sword drill. 9:20, for those who remember such things. Daniel 9:24-27. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come in a flood. Even to the end there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolation desolate, even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Here we've even got numbers and ways of timing the coming of the Messiah, but it's difficult to know what to do with those numbers and how to calculate the time when the Messiah will come. And as you're all aware, there are more prophecies in Daniel, many of them very difficult to interpret. I'm not going to read any more of these. I'll just point out that in Micah, it indicates that the Messiah will come from Bethlehem. So there we've got something. Zechariah says much about the coming Messiah, but it too is hard to decipher. And then we have the Old Testament ending. I'll just read the last couple verses of the Old Testament in Malachi chapter 4, starting with verse 4. "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, even the statutes and ordinances which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I am going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. And he will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the land with a curse." So here it's not really directly tied to the Messiah, but we have an Elijah coming before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And this Elijah is going to restore the hearts of the fathers, restore them to obedience. Okay. What's the picture that's painted here? Let me just summarize the kind of picture that's painted here. A Messiah is coming. It's not entirely clear. Some of the prophecies seem to be indicating to a line of a dynastic line that's coming. Others seem to be suggesting an individual. They can certainly be taken that way. This Messiah will be born to the line of Abraham through David, and even more specifically in some of the later prophets through Zerubbabel. So it narrows it down to which genealogical line this Messiah will come from. He'll be born in Bethlehem, and he will have something to do with Galilee. So we've got a little bit of geographical information that we can place him on a map. But beyond that, it's the picture of someone who's going to come and lead Israel into victory with respect to the surrounding oppressors. A kingly leader that will defeat all of their enemies and will inaugurate a just rule, not only in Israel, but in the entire world. And that kingdom will be eternal. Those are the things that become quite clear from the Old Testament prophecies. But as far as other identifying marks, they're hard to come by. Other things that we can look for that will help us to spot the Messiah, those are hard to come by. So it would have been quite natural for people in 20 AD to fill in with their imaginations. Well, what would this be? I mean, think about it. If God, the creator of the universe, a transcendent God, were to become man, what would he look like? What kind of car would he show up in? I mean, it's got to be a Rolls Royce. I mean, as you're thinking about what are the trappings of this Messiah, I mean, I should back up. It's not really clear sometimes whether the Messiah is going to be God himself, but he's certainly a representative of God himself. And if you fill in with your imagination, given the prophecies, you would expect somebody who's going to stand out. Someone who is a superman. Someone who's really distinctive. We would particularly expect that after looking at the section in 1 Samuel that we just looked at. That's exactly what the Israelites were looking for when they asked for a king. They asked for a king, and what did they want? They wanted a kingly kind of person. They wanted a champion, someone who could lead them in battle, someone who was strong and dynamic. And they wanted results. They wanted victories, specifically. It seems to me, if you think about it in these terms, it would have been easy to miss the Messiah. He would have been hard to spot. I mean, Jesus walking down the street in Nazareth is not going to immediately strike you as, that's the Messiah. That's the one who will rule the world. It doesn't fit. And it is interesting to me that those who were the most diligent students of the Bible at the time didn't spot him. I've often thought that knowledge of Scripture would be the kind of thing that would keep one safe and allow one to identify God and God at work. And that's not necessarily the case. The Pharisees were great students of the Bible, but they were focused wrongly. And as a result, the clues that were there, they didn't pick up on. What did prepare a person for spotting the Messiah? The way I understand it is that God chose to appear in human form. That in Jesus, God took on human form. So what he did was kind of like what an artist does when an artist makes a self-portrait. And the problem is, if I'm the artist, how do I reduce myself? I'm a three-dimensional living being. So there are lots of dimensions to me. How do I reproduce that, translate that into something on a canvas, which is two-dimensional static? something is going to get lost in that translation. So the artist has to make a decision, and the decision that the artist has to make is, what is it that is essentially me that is most important to retain on the canvas? Jesus, in translating himself from his transcendence and in his divinity into flesh, has to go through a similar kind of translation, and he can't represent it all there. It can't be done. So what he has to do is he has to make sure that his essence is retained. And in that process, it's interesting what God chose as his essence, the thing that he would like everyone to know about him. And it isn't that which we would naturally guess. What was most important for him to retain was moral character. That's what was embodied in Jesus. And that's what's essentially God. That is that aspect of God that God himself is most proud. And it seems to me that those who spotted the Messiah were the ones who had come to understand that moral character is that which is nearest and dearest to God himself. It's those who learned to recognize a spirit that was devoted to truth and righteousness. So if we compare then what was typically expected of the Messiah with what God did, what kind of translation, what kind of representative of God the Messiah would be, what was typically expected was this Superman, this champion of men. What qualities would he have? Well, you can imagine. Handsome, brave, intelligent, winsome, physically strong, witty, well-born. In general, it's someone whose mere presence automatically commands respect from fellow human beings. That's what they expected. And what was Jesus? He was one who was committed to truth, who valued love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, the fruits of the Spirit. And one who automatically commanded the respect of those who value righteousness. Think about it. If there were a big party, and God decided he would like to take on human form and crash that party, where would he show up in that party? Would he be the MC, the master of ceremonies? Would he be the main act? Or would he be the one carrying around the tray of hors d'oeuvres to give to everyone? I mean, there's a sense in which the latter is fitting him. I mean, if you understand who he is and what he values, there's something fitting about him being there, not to be up front, not to be on show, but to be the servant. Those who could recognize Jesus for who he was were the ones who could learn to recognize beauty when they saw it. A true beauty. Not physical beauty, but real moral beauty of the soul. A beauty not found in pious acts, but in a reverence of spirit. A beauty not found in fame, but in divine approval. And a beauty of being served, not of being served, but of a beauty of serving. This true beauty could also be described as righteousness. And it was those who understood that from their study of the Old Testament and from the activity of God working in their hearts that when they saw Jesus, they saw that beauty. And they recognized the significance of that. Okay, I think what I have said up to now is a fair representation of what the Bible has to say. What I'm going to say now is speculation. I put this in a different category. But it has occurred to me, when I read prophetic passages in the Bible, I have to admit, my mind usually just kind of turns off because I figure it's hopeless. They are so difficult to interpret. So this is not based on my knowledge of prophecy, but it has occurred to me that the time could come when God could provide the world with the kind of person that human beings want as a leader. That one could come along, a human being could come along with all of these traits that I've described of handsome, strong, well-born, well-spoken, intelligent, winsome. Such a person could come along, and such a person could come along and do great things, bring peace, have some significant accomplishments with respect to bringing peace and concord in this world. And it seems to me such a person could even come along who God would give the authority to perform wonders. That person could even be pious. And if such a person were to come along, would we be able to tell whether that was true or whether that was counterfeit? My suspicion is that if such a person were to come along, that would be very attractive. That would be very attractive to most of mankind. And it is interesting to me that Christ himself had said, had wondered out loud whether when he comes again, whether he would still find faith. And it seems to me that the situation could develop in such a way that all of us would be tempted to turn astray and follow this kind of leader that man has always wanted. It seems to me that it is very important for us to learn to appreciate true beauty, moral beauty, righteousness. We need to be able to recognize it when we see it. We need to learn what it is. We need to learn to seek it. And we need to learn to appreciate it in others and to help foster it in others. And I see this as a joint project. It's the kind of thing where we need one another's help. But it's only coming to recognize true beauty that's going to preserve us, I think. Because life is going to get complicated. Life is going to get confusing. We need clarity. And we need to be able to see that which is true and genuine and that which is not. Christ is going to come again, and it is a question, who will be able to recognize him when he comes again? And I would say on the basis of the first coming, that we can expect that the second coming will not be quite as we envision it happening. Okay. Questions, comments?
You were speaking about how some of the earlier, what I grew up considering to be prophecies, the vinegar to drink, etc., were not so much prophecies, but poetic language that was used to describe the author's own suffering, etc. And would you say then that they, I mean, how does that work in the Bible? They become later signs? Become signs after the fact?
The way I'm thinking about it is, what David was describing there, I think, was his own experience. And he used poetic language to do that. So it's not prophetic in the sense that it's predictive, that someone before the time of Christ could read that and say, oh, I know what's going to happen. It's not that kind of prophecy. But to my mind, God has, in all of history, God has woven a very complicated story with a lot of foreshadowing, a lot of details that that come out in bits and pieces early on that only become clarified later and get tied together later. And in so doing, he superintended the words that David wrote such that when Christ suffered, he suffered those in a way that was more literally, those passages become more literally true of him than they were of David. And I think that that was done as a way to call our attention to what purpose Christ served, what was going on.
And more of his, and more of his continuity through history.
Yes, and the fact that he is the culmination of these themes that developed much earlier.
Well, God's a talented writer.
He is. He's even better than J.C. Rowling. But the same kind, but it's the same kind. I haven't even read these books, but my whole family are great fans of the Harry Potter series. And one of the things that they like to do is put together the clues to try to figure out how everything ties together. Well, it seems to me that both in Scripture and in history, God has told a similar kind of story that invites us to put together the clues to follow the threads.
When you speak about prophecy, then when you're using that phrase, the prophet is doing so intentionally, and speaking of Christ, foretelling of Christ intentionally, and it's not an incidental. Then, I mean, I'm trying to narrow down where you say prophecy occurs.
Well, what prophecy is a complicated thing. I'm just making the distinction here between what could reasonably be seen by a reader as predicting something that would happen in the future. There are some passages here that I think a reader could reasonably be assumed to say these are predicting something in the future. Mm-hmm. But with respect to those Psalms, I don't think that a reader could reasonably assume that these are being predicting something in the future. Mm-hmm. That's the distinction I'm making. Mm-hmm.
Well, David, you've done it again. You opened up a question that I'd love to hear more about. Can you elaborate a little bit on this, the beauty that you talked about, that we're to see in other people, encourage in other people? Can you elaborate just a little bit on what that looks like, and even more, how do we encourage that in other people?
Well, it's the beauty that I'm talking about is true. Is true spiritual beauty. So we're talking about righteousness, essentially. And how do we spot righteousness? It's a matter of being taught to focus on what righteousness is. And ultimately, that's the work of the Holy Spirit within us, to give us the eyes to see that, to give us the ability to see that and not to be distracted by other things. How do we foster righteousness within ourselves? How do we know what it is? Well, we study. We reflect upon what God is teaching us through our experience and through the Bible. It's just something that we have to keep working on and processing constantly and seeking to do that which is righteous. And that's a huge part of learning what is righteous, is constantly seeking to do that which is righteous. And how do we encourage that in others? By teaching, by example, and by encouragement. Just, it's like we're all on a big backpacking trip. And there's always that time when you forget that it's fun, and it's hard to get up and keep going. And it's a matter of all of us encouraging one another, let's just keep going. This is worth it. We need to just keep going.
When I think about this, I think that when you were talking about how would we recognize him as a king, I think all the prophecies that were talked about Jesus coming, we weren't supposed to, nobody was supposed to recognize who he was, that he was supposed to come, and Jesus had a thing that he had to do, and that was die on a cross. So nobody was really supposed to recognize him until that was finished. Now that after he's done this, it's like you said, this puzzle we put together as we, now that we look back on it, we see all these prophets. This is the one. Everything is pointing towards him, that he's now the Messiah. He's now the king. And now that we see this king and we put this puzzle together, we now see what we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. That's the way I can.
Well, it is, there's a sense in which it is easier after the fact to put some of the pieces of the puzzle together because more of the pieces are there. That's true. But there were some who recognized him as the Messiah even before he went to his death on the cross.
Those people that were mostly in very close contact with him, they recognized it sooner, and they were just part of the,
well,
I think.
In some cases that's true, but there's like the woman at the well in John, which is a fascinating little vignette where Jesus leads her through a series of questions and comments, leads her to an understanding of the fact that he's the Messiah.
Okay. And what I meant is as a whole. In other words, I think the whole world wasn't supposed to pick it up just like that. But then it would have defeated the purpose of Christ going to the cross. Now that we see that, everybody come after that can see this and understand that this is what they needed to do to recognize him. And then that teaches us how to live our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things that seems clear to me is that it's not number of clues that makes it easier for us to spot the Messiah, but rather it's perspective on those, on what it is that we're looking for. And that is a gift from God. I mean, that's, and there will only be a few that will ever gain that perspective.
I agree with that.
Given the fact of the 2020 hindsight, mm-hmm. of course, it's not really 2020 because it's still difficult. But just wondering about, you know, it seems real obvious why or rational, logical why the majority of the Jews at the time of Christ had a completely different concept. I mean, they were looking at the same things, mm-hmm. looking at the same scriptures, and had a somewhat reasonable misunderstanding.
Yes.
I mean, I think, you know, there's a certain sense in which we can point the finger at the Pharisees and say how bad they are. But I think if we really think about it, we'd have to realize that if we were living back then, it probably would have been very easy for us to be right there along with them.
Right.
Now, you know, we've got all these years have gone by, where you can put a lot of the pieces together. And it is rather remarkable how many statements in the Old Testament correspond so well with the life of Christ, and especially things like the suffering servant and those things in some of the passages in the Psalms. So what are the, you know, devout Jews today doing with those things? I mean, I'm sure that many, there's quite a movement, I know, between Christians and devout Jews to have discussions about Old Testament prophecy and sort of in the spirit of, you know, kind of an ecumenical sort of bringing the walls a little lower, you know, and for friendship and what have you. And I know that those discussions must be fairly common. What do the Jews say now about that?
I don't know that I can answer that because I don't know exactly what Jews are saying. But just from my experience and interaction with Jews, it has become clear to me that their cultural identity is important to them. And to acknowledge that Jesus was the Messiah undermines their cultural identity. It's like betraying everything that's happened to Jews in the millennia past. And so there's a lot of resistance, it seems to me, on the part of Jews to acknowledging Jesus Christ as the Messiah. But there's a blindness there, but kind of what I've been thinking is there's another kind of blindness that concerns me as well, and that is a blindness on the part of Christians to see Christ. And that's what I'm wondering is, even those who would say all of this stuff was predictive of the Messiah to come, and would acknowledge Christ as the Messiah and as the Savior, would they recognize him if he came today? And how easily would people be led astray if you put up something that looked more impressive? This time, would they say, that's the real thing, rather than the real thing being the real thing? I mean, can we identify the real thing? And that is a problem for Jews then, it's a problem for us as Christians now, is what is true beauty? What is true righteousness? And that's a serious question, and I think an important one. Okay. Merry Christmas to all of you. This is a truly wonderful holiday, I think, and it's something well worth celebrating.